sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
New Brexit poll spooks markets. Oil rally is, well, fizzling. We're looking ahead to the June Fed rate decision this week and how not to use levered ETFs. All this and much more on episode number 466 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz and I'm your host. We're going to spend some time together talking about a variety of different topics. Clearly, we have to talk about the Brexit poll that came out. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But we also have to talk about some things that happened last week and some things that we're looking forward to this coming week. Because last week was rather light in terms of economic and other data from central banks and from other sources that would be market moving. Markets were in a bit of a consolidation mode. It looked like just for a little while there, they wanted to actually hit an all-time high again, which is interesting considering all the different headwinds and backdrops of fundamentals and things that are playing out in terms of the differing central bank opinions, negative interest rates, you know, the list, the whole list. But we did see that just on a couple of points, we saw that crude inventories did in fact fall again. We saw, of course, that was a result of some of the oil being offline due to fires in Canada that we know about, and also the cut of the Nigerian pipelines due to the rebels. And that was somewhat bullish for the oil market in the beginning of the week. However, towards the end of the week, as it looked like there was a blow-off top, a bullish blow-off top. This is when you see a rally going on. There could be things called like a flag pattern, or there could be just a simple short squeeze rally that continues on for some time. Nothing can keep it down. All of a sudden, you do see that point where all of a sudden, there's this massive push above and a vertical move of a price, whether it's oil or a stock or other, any other index that may be. You call this blow-off tops. You see very high volume potentially, and then all of a sudden, there's a lack of participation at that point. And things turn around. It's kind of when all of the buyers are finally there to a point that they give in, a capitulation, we call it sometimes, where it's just like, okay, we're buying. Now, this also is the opposite of this is true also when you look at things like capitulation lows, where you see that everybody just says, oh, forget it. I'm just selling. I'm done. I'm not dealing with this anymore. I don't want to hold this position. This thing has been dropping for some time. I'm past the point of the pain that I could take any longer. And all of a sudden, the bottom falls out. And you see that usually, again, of a very sharp move to the downside with a significant amount of volume. Now, when that happens, you sometimes can look at that as an opportunity to start to very gently move into a position, even though it may be looking like what is supposed to not be invested in, what's called a falling knife, of course. But still, when you see these kind of conditions that arise, whether it's a blow-off top or a capitulation bottom, these are times that are often the ripest for a quick, we'll call it swing trade, at least if nothing else, if it doesn't work out. If it works out, obviously it can turn around into a continuation trade and you continue on with that move. And that is something that you want to look at. So we did see that there was quite a bit of buying activity after the close on Wednesday. Then Thursday, again, the same situation happened. After the regular markets, the pit closes of oil, and all of a sudden, towards the end of the day, started moving higher. Then when the markets closed, the U.S. equity markets closed at the end of the day on Thursday, there was a bit of a spike up again. And it looked like it could be the start of what we call a blow-off top. And lo and behold, Friday, things turned around, and oil started to drop pretty significantly throughout the day. and still above 49 on WTI crude. And some of this also is related to the futures contract rolling from one contract to the next contract for oil. But this is something that you do want to watch for and you want to take a look at, because there was nothing else really in the news that was seen in terms of the supply issue, except for the fact that when you saw the Baker Hughes report on Friday, which is the end of the day on Friday, there were more rigs put back into production, more put back online. And that is often a sign that there's going to be greater production. And as prices stabilize in the, we'll call it the around 50 area, there was additional potential for more oil coming back to the market. Now, last week, again, there wasn't a lot of economic reports that were put out. We had some productivity numbers that came in that looked just about in line, a little bit higher than estimated by just a small amount. Unit labor costs actually did come in a bit higher, meaning that it's costing employers more to actually pay their employees. That could be due to some of the continuing implementation of the higher minimum wage laws in various states. But other than that, really, you know, MBA mortgage applications came out, not a high priority issue. Initial claims were at 264, right in line. The Michigan University of Michigan consumer sentiment came out, and that was right within line too. Nothing major there. Now, let's talk about what's going on next week, because I think next week we have a full board of economic reports that are coming out from the U.S. We also have the continuation of this Brexit polls that we'll be seeing, and a lot of commentary out of Europe on that. We saw Jack Lew over the weekend came in with some comments, the Treasury Secretary of the U.S., about how it would be pretty ugly for the European banks and financial system and the financial system around the world, and was trying to push back on this and make sure that, hey, you know what? You guys got to stay. Don't do it. Just don't do it. You're playing with fire here. But coming up on Tuesday, we have retail sales that are going to be, I think, viewed as highly important. Forecasts are for about 0.3% increase on a month-over-month basis. Last month, they were 0.8. So we'll see how that plays. Still not a major number. Business inventories are going to be coming out. Again, that plays a little bit into GDP. Those have been on the rise. We saw that wholesale inventories couple of weeks ago were just blah. We're going to see also on Wednesday the PPI, the Producer Price Index, which is inflation at the wholesale level, manufacturing level. And we're looking at pretty much nothing there. 0.1% is where it's been for some time, 0.2%, 0.3%, right around that level for that. Now, of course, CPI always follows a couple days later or a day later. So we have CPI on Thursday looking for a 0.3% month-over-month change. On a core basis, 0.2%. So the headline's 0.3, core CPI 0.2. But before that, of course, on Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we have the FOMC rate decision. Now, remember something, that after the jobs number came out last week, that the odds and probability of a rate hike in June, which was seemingly like a done deal, dropped down significantly to less than 3% or less than 4%, like 3.8%. It was 20% prior. So now we're talking about a 3% chance of a rate hike. Now, at the same time, many of the speakers have talked about how it is going to be a, quote, live meeting. A live meeting, meaning that anything can happen. And there is a chance that they could raise rates. I don't know why they would do so at this point, because they've gotten the market to believe that at least they could push it back to July. And we know how dovish this overall Fed has been. A lot of talk, very little action. Seems that in between meetings, just a tremendous amount of scuttlebutt about how they're going to raise rates. And they're so excited. And then when it comes to a meeting, they're like, maybe next time. You know, they just can't pull the trigger. And there's some reasons why they shouldn't. However, it is beginning to sink in, I think, to economies, politicians, central bankers, to a lesser degree, and clearly investors, that going significantly lower in rates is not helping anything. Negative rates have been backfiring significantly. Finishing off the week, we have initial claims, of course, on Thursday, Philly Fed, which I watch. And we have housing starts and building permits on Friday. Pretty much done with the previous quarter's earnings season. Looking forward to the next few weeks starting up all over again with the next earnings season. We have probably about three weeks, yeah, remaining till the next earnings season comes. So right now we're in a bit of a period where there's really not a lot of things happening from core companies. We'll have a few out there that will be the tells on some of the things for the next quarter, but generally speaking, not a lot of significant amount of earnings coming out. So news flow, you have a few things that are going to probably kick up. Clearly, this whole Brexit issue. We have some of the FOMC and then the odds on and bets going on whether or not there'll be another rate hike this year. Oil is probably going to be something that's very interesting. There was a bit of a decoupling of oil prices and the movement of oil from equity markets, but that kind of fell apart on Friday. And all of a sudden, there is the thought that maybe we overshot the levels, which happens quite often with prices, considering the overall inventory levels and production and the temporary nature of some of the things that have been slowing down some of the inventory gains that we mentioned. So those are a couple things that are probably going to be the big deciders of how markets play out right now. But as we've seen before, markets have turned on a dime either direction so many times in the last year and a half, 2 years, more so over the last year and a half, I think because of the fact that the Fed has been much more in play and has been much more vocal about their desire to do something. But again, we'll see what happens there. One of the things that I thought we would talk about today is this whole idea of the Brexit. I mean, we've been hearing a lot of news about this. We've been hearing about, you know, the potential for a Brexit vote to happen towards the end of June. I believe it's June 23rd. So we're only talking about, what, about 2 weeks away from now, where we're going to get a seemingly final resolution to this whole idea of, the UK, Great Britain, England leaving the Eurozone. And the question really remains is what does that mean for markets, and why is there so much concern here? Well, the biggest issue is that there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty that's surrounding this. And that's really the biggest problem that markets are reacting to right now. In fact, on Friday, there was another poll done. And this time, the news headlines came out and said that the parties that were voting to leave rather than stay gained a tremendous amount of momentum recently. Now, that being the case, well, that's a problem. Because, again, the banking industry, financial system, the whole idea of the entirety of the Eurozone project, if you will, is called into question. Now, this is something that I have talked about for years, not understanding exactly why this whole thing was slated to work with the current design. Yet different, different countries that had different bonds and different governments, and they're trying to bring this all together under a common currency and a common, sort of a common financial system. And since the time that this has been brought together, I think we could all agree this has failed miserably. Even though they're trying to do many of the things that we're doing here in terms of quantitative easing and low interest rates, you know, we saw that the German bonds hit an all-time low last week, ahead of even the poll that came out. And when we saw the results of this poll, immediately markets in the U.S. tanked. We saw that the British pound sank. We saw that currencies kind of went into disarray. Markets in Europe were closed at the time when the actual poll results came out, but nonetheless, they were still down 2.5% ahead of that. Pretty ugly. Now, one of the things you could have seen and what we have noticed over the last several months is the incredible weakness of many of the financial institutions inside of the Eurozone. For example, we talked about how poorly Deutsche Bank has been doing and Credit Suisse, Banco Santander. And these are, I think, if nothing else, the canaries in the coal mine. These are the ones that are telling us that something's just not right there, even though markets in the U.S. approached close to about a 1% level away from the all-time high that we reached some time ago, ignoring the potential for the Brexit, which may have some reverberations. Clearly, to financial markets and the financial systems in Europe, but also potentially bleeding over into our markets over here. That's the biggest concern, that we're going to see some kind of reverberation, because the financial systems around the world are so closely integrated, and they have so much reliance on each other, not only from the coordination of central banks that we've seen over the last several years, but also due to the interrelationship of the banking system. And trying to extract one country out of this Eurozone organization. I mean, if you remember back to how things got so out of hand when everybody thought that Greece was going to go into default to go bankrupt, which essentially they did, but they were saved, right? They were rescued at the last second by just, of course, more loans, more money into the system that would weigh down their overall economic growth for years to come, never recovering, keeping the economy in a miserable state. But nonetheless, the fear of a country like Greece leaving the European Union and leaving the scar of unraveling all of the financials, currencies, was just too much for markets to deal with. And that's why, at the time, the ECB came in and the various countries within Europe came in to rescue Greece, because they knew this was going to be a major problem to get beyond. And now we're seeing something much bigger, the potential for a country that has a very good economy, massive, again, they're a little bit separate. There's a bit of a difference between Greece, clearly, and well, many of the countries, obviously. But still, because there is a bit of a separation, a different currency, by the way, you don't have some of the problems that you would have had with Greece going back to the drachma, leaving the euro, you know, the euro currency itself. But still, there is a major problem here, because I think it is a screaming confirmation that this experiment is not working. And who else may be the next to potentially leave? Will Germany follow suit? France? Spain? Portugal? Or maybe Greece will try it again? They'll try to do what they can to move out of the European Union altogether. So I think this, more importantly than anything else, is this confirmation that this is a failed experiment that can't be resurrected. And if, in fact, we do see that there is a breakup through this Brexit of at least a part of one of the strongest countries inside of that process, inside of that overall union, if you will, then, you know, again, they are separate. It's not, they're not like Germany, so embroiled inside of the Eurozone, inside the European Union. But they still have they're a major component in this. And by leaving, it's just going, I think, throw this whole thing into I think there's going to be a lack of confidence, a lack of faith. Investors are going to question why they should be investing there. What is the next shoe to drop? They obviously can't hold things up. I mean, again, we're seeing that the ECB is purchasing everything and anything possible. Recently, as of last week, going in and buying corporate bonds now. They're just out of things to buy. Interest rates below zero on the German Bund, and far lower on sovereign debt in countries like in Spain, in Italy, compared to the U.S. Now, I'll ask you, wouldn't you agree that, generally speaking, a bond of a country whose economy is strong should have a higher price, lower yield, than a country that is not strong or very weak? How do you compare Italy and Spain as examples to the U.S.? And why is the interest rate on their bonds, their various sovereign bonds, various years throughout the yield curve, so much lower than ours here? Something's not right with the system. Clearly, there's a very big disparity there, and that's why there has been such a thrust, in my belief, towards investing in U.S. stocks. If we're yielding, the S&P is yielding 3%, let's say. 3%. Well, if you have the choice to invest in a interim term bond, like a 5-year, 10-year bond that's yielding, let's say, sub 1%, 0.5%, 0.25%, or in U.S. stocks that have 3.5%, and some individually much more. If you get into the area of utilities and REITs and some of the other higher yielding stocks that are in the U.S. markets, what are you going to choose? It makes all the sense in the world to even do an arbitrage where you take money out at very low rates and arbitrage and margin them up, lever them up to buy the stocks that are yielding much higher levels in the U.S. And that is part of the driver, because we're not seeing that individuals, clearly we're seeing that individuals have been on a tear taking money out of equity mutual funds and equity ETFs in the U.S. So it's not individuals, you and I, that maybe are the ones that say, hey, you know what? Valuations are good. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to start really pounding into the markets because I believe that the long term or even the shorter term, let's call it the next 12 months, is going to be really good for markets because, you know, we're seeing earnings growth. We're seeing the economy expand. We're seeing all these good things that are happening. Consumer spending is rising. No, that's not the case. And because of that, we have to look for what is actually going on here. And it only makes sense that we have money from outside operations, such as other, maybe even pension funds of other countries around the world, Japan, China, possibly, clearly Europe, that some of these have much lower yields that they can borrow from and then leverage it up somewhere else. Especially those countries like Europe and Japan that have negative rates on deposit if they leave their money on deposit with the Fed or the central banks of their various countries, they're losing money. They don't want to do that. So again, what's the alternative? The whole point is, if you really think of this, it's kind of like a giant funnel, whereas you have a few of them in front of you and a few choices in front of you, but in the end, everything is funneled into the same place, into a very small end that has been reduced down to an area that is the only possible investable area. And that's why we're seeing so much money seemingly come into individual equities and futures and things of that nature. But again, on the retail side, it's being extracted. So as we're seeing this money leave from the retail investors, it only leaves the institutions and maybe sovereign wealth funds and possibly even governments, not directly in the sovereign wealth funds, but even governments looking to invest. We know that Japan invests directly in their markets. They invest in equities, in ETFs. They invest in REITs in their markets. The ECB doesn't seem to have a problem investing in all sorts of things, so who knows where that money's going. So I think that when we look at this and we look at the valuations of markets, we look at all of the things that are going on around the world with regard to low oil, but not as low as it's been, and the slowdown from that, we see that recent jobs number that we saw last week at about 38,000 added to the payrolls, and then, okay, add some back for the Verizon strike and all that, and maybe even 70,000, but yet we're seeing a 4.7% unemployment rate with a Fed that is standing on the edge of a potential rate hike, of course, with a caveat that it seems that they will probably not do it, talk it up a lot, but not do it if, in fact, this whole Brexit issue comes to a fore, and if in fact markets start to fall, you know, they are very market focused, not only domestically, but globally, because they have this coordinated process with other central banks, and they're not going to go and start raising rates very significantly. They know that the labor participation rate has dropped significantly. 450 or 500,000 people left the workforce, and that's one of the reasons why I was seeing this anomaly in the statistics when it comes to the unemployment rate at 4.7%. Now, is it really something much greater than that, or maybe closer to 5% where it's been? You know, that's hard to discern right now, but clearly it's not 4.75% or 4.7%, as they say, rounded down. It's not 4.7% because we know that that's really just a statistical measure because of all the people that left the job force, how they actually calculate. Why in the world we can't get a straight up calculation to give us information that is reliable and usable is unbelievable. Why we have to go and extract out the labor participation rate, look at things like shadow stats to see what would have been the unemployment rate utilizing the quote unquote old formulation. It's amazing that there is so much I guess just twisting of facts to meet the end goals of whatever the party is that is actually presenting the facts. And this is what we talked about also on the DH Unplugged show with the whole non-GAAP earnings and the SEC now cracking down on many companies who have been utilizing non-GAAP earnings to make things look a lot better than they really are. It's kind of funny and perverse in a way that the government is going to be cracking down on companies that are using statistics to their benefit versus doing something on their own, the government, to actually clean up their act as well. But we know how that goes, right? Politics. The end of the day, the non-GAAP is a way that, which is outside the generally accepted accounting principles. And this is a process that many companies have been using recently to show that their numbers are better because they can exclude certain items from the overall earnings, include others in there to make things look a little bit better from an expense and revenue standpoint. And but the SEC is saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, this isn't fair. And not in all cases, but this isn't fair how you can actually start burying things. We talked about this a bit, but this is the same exact thing when it comes to statistics. Where it comes to the numbers that we're seeing, whether it comes to the headlines about this Brexit, is it going to happen or not? When it comes to the expectations of markets from the aspect of what we are looking at, because if you think about it, for the most part, markets as of just recently have pretty much been discounting all of the bad news. All the bad news seems to be looked at as another way for the stimulus train to continue rolling for a period longer than it has been. And that's why when we saw that after the jobs number that came out, it really wasn't a major market hit, where we see that the service number in terms of ISM services kind of starts slowing down. So that inventories and GDP are looking pretty ugly, where we saw that more deflation in Japan is showing up very significantly. And a slowdown in Europe continues, and not to mention the continual slowdown in China, which is a major economy. It doesn't seem to really resonate very much with markets. You add to that the outlook for earnings that everybody knows is clearly a concern. But you know what? The silver lining is that companies have been very, quote, conservative with their guidance, allowing the bar to be lowered by analysts, therefore allowing them to beat earnings next quarter. That's how we get these 70% of companies beating on a regular basis each and every quarter. Because companies have been extremely conservative, or sometimes called sandbagging it, where they actually will, you know, guide lower than expected because they know they can beat it. So they figure, you know what, we'll say we're going to make 5 cents. We know we're going to make about seven or eight. Give us a bit of a cushion there. And as such, they can beat that by a nice margin. And then investors are all happy and everybody's excited. And then they come out and say, well, next quarter may not be so good. Now, one of the problems has been, and one of the things you really need to focus in on, is earnings growth. What has been the year-over-year gain in earnings on a percentage basis over periods to periods to periods? We want to look at like periods historically. So we look at the first quarter to first quarter, second quarter, et cetera. And when you look at that, what do those numbers show? That's what the important thing is. It's not that, well, they came in at a dollar and they expected to have 75 cents. Wow, they beat by 25 cents. Okay, that's great. But what did they have a year ago? Do they have $1.60, $1.50, or 40 cents? Now, they had 40 cents and they come in and they beat by they beat their numbers. And in fact, they came in at a dollar. That's good. Then we have to look at last quarter and the quarter before that, and see how the companies are doing not only there, but also in revenues, expansion of margin, and return on equity. These are important issues that have been pretty much ignored over the last year and a half, 2 years. Now, I'm not suggesting that markets should be cratering or anything like that, because markets are markets and price is what it is. But fundamentally, I think we all know in the back of our minds, we really know. And I even think those that are really bullish out there that are talking about how, these are only temporary conditions, et cetera, they may be, but they are the conditions. I think they know. I think they really know in their heart of hearts, in the back of their heads, and in everything that they know about markets and about finance and about fundamentals. The bottom line is that something's not matching up so well. So just keep that in mind. Where's the right valuation? Well, the right valuation is where we are, wherever that seems to be. That is the correct and current valuation. Can't fight that. So the numbers don't lie when it comes to the actual levels, because that's how much is being valued at the current time for the markets with all the news that is currently available. So you can't say the markets are wrong or markets are right. I love when you get a number out of some economic report and markets swoon, take a really big hit. And then they got those players that come out, particularly from the central bank, say, "Yo, the market's got it wrong. Oh, they got it wrong. You know, they didn't really read this number right. You know, they should have seen this and they didn't pick up on that. I think the market's got it wrong." The funniest thing is two things. One, when the markets scream higher, when's the last time you remember somebody coming out and saying, "Well, the market's got it wrong," especially from the government, any politician, central banks? You don't see that. The second thing is markets don't get it wrong. Markets get it right for the time period they get it right. Because we're not talking about just one person flipping a switch on or off, buy or sell. We're talking about a massive environment of individual investors, institutional investors, algorithmic traders, high-frequency traders, hedge funds, mutual funds. You know, you have an entirety of all the information that comes in and then is being, invested upon, being made decisions on. And then, therefore, what you have is the level that is correct for that moment. Just remember that. The prices don't lie. The prices are the prices. Now, are they going to change as there is a different set of conditions that is revealed over time? Absolutely. The closer we get to this Brexit vote, maybe the more we see, and if there is a continuation of a change in the dynamic when it comes to employment, that will change things as well. So when you're looking at your portfolio and you're looking at the markets and you're maybe sitting there fighting something, you know what? It is okay to say, "Well, I think this is really, from all the information I have, this is the right positioning. This is the right stock, maybe. Maybe you have information on a stock. Maybe it's a sector. Maybe it's an asset class entirely." But at the same time, realize that there are a lot of opinions out there. And if you're the only one that has this one opinion and you think you're right, well, you know what? You're wrong. Right? I mean, if everybody else is right, or everybody else is wrong and you're right, well, you're wrong when it comes to markets. If you got 500 people in a room that say one thing and you say the other, at least at that moment, you're wrong. So we saw that Carl Icahn and George Soros last week. George Soros, interestingly, 85 years old, decided, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to get back into the day-to-day trading operations of my family office, of my firm." 85 years old. I don't know. I'm not sure if he thought that maybe the people at his firm weren't as aggressive as they should be, or maybe they were making the wrong decisions, or they wouldn't go with some of the thoughts that he had. But he came out and said he is getting back involved directly with trading, the day-to-day trading operations, and at the same time, laying off a pretty big bet on the downside for markets. That was earlier in the week. Then Carl Icahn came out and talked about a few things and how he also, I said, I think the numbers are 150% net short of markets. Now, he's been that way for the last month or so. So that means that he's not doing so well right now with those particular positions that are, you know, on a market short, if you will. But nonetheless, he came out and then confirmed what, you know, Soros was saying. And then, of course, you got the funny tweeters out there that are talking about, "Yeah, look at this old grumpy old men's club." The grumpy old men's club is out there saying, "Hey, you know what? I'm not sure. Markets are not looking good, and I think we're going to start seeing a downstroke and all that." These are just curmudgeons. These are the tweets that I've been seeing. And what's interesting about that is really, let's kind of a little bit of a kickback here, a little bit of a pushback by me, that I think that maybe these 25 and 30-year-old journalists who haven't seen much of market conditions over time and only really lived in a world where central banks have been in control of throwing incredible liquidity and gasoline on a fire, and also that have had the safety nets there in the event of any kind of economic and market slowdown. That's all they've been a part of. So, you know, they maybe, just maybe, I don't know what you think about this, but just maybe some of these older chaps have a little bit more worldly experience and have seen all sorts of conditions over the last 50 years, plus 60 years, I guess, for in the case, or maybe 65 years, in the case of George Soros, whereas there have been conditions that have arisen that are times to be bullish and times to be bearish. So maybe we have to, you know, yield a little bit towards, you know, their thinking and some of the insight that they're providing us for markets. Just a thought. Just a thought. So anyway, the summation of this is that this Brexit issue, we're going to see it come, probably a lot more news that will come out about the potential direction of the vote. And I would just say that the potential also for additional volatility is quite high into that. Now, markets have been very resilient. We know that with almost every single downstroke, we've seen buyers come out of the woodworks from somewhere. Again, not retail because they're selling out of mutual funds and ETFs. But we've seen a tremendous amount of buyers coming and buying dips and ramping stock markets higher and markets being very resilient and almost insulated from a lot of the negative headlines that we've seen. Now, again, these kind of things turn on a dime, just like market downtrends turn on a dime that we've seen. And recently, we came just a stone throw away from the all-time high again, right inside that channel. If you take a chart of the S&P 500, you'll see that we're right inside the channel. Now, the SPY, the SPY ETF, actually broke to a new high because that includes dividends. When you reinvest the SPY, you have dividends that come along with it, whereas the S&P 500, when they quote it, does not include dividends. And when you have about a 3% dividend yield on the S&P 500, well, the SPY includes that, especially on a dividend-adjusted basis, and you see that the dividends actually helped it reach an all-time high recently. With that in mind, we saw that small caps have been very strong still in the with the idea that they are very much tied to the valuation of the U.S. dollar. A lot of small caps in the small cap universe, you have a lot of oil and gas and commodity and other things outside of just the straight-up industrials and the really very strong companies inside of an S&P 500. So you would have seen that risk has been on and there has been a very bullish overall attitude. And again, a very much resilient market when it comes to more of the aggressive positions that are out there and the ones that have popped up recently. We know that we've seen materials that have come up a long way. Many of the oil and gas related types of companies have come up a long way from their lows. And commodities, and even agriculture. We've seen a lot of change as the dollar has fallen recently. Now, whether or not this whole Brexit issue will have an effect on the dollar, we already saw that the pound had dropped sharply. The euro is coming in. The yen is going actually up. And we're seeing the dollar still continue down a little bit lower against some currencies. But again, you're going to see probably a significant amount of weakness with the pound, if in fact this Brexit vote continues on and the conversation continues that there is going to be the potential for a separation. And Friday's market clearly showed us right on that, the news of that vote, whether or not the vote, the poll information came out that things are a little bit concerning when it comes to that. Now, let's kind of switch over to the whole idea of, you know, what to do at this point with all of this, because, you know, where do you go? You got the VIX currently at about 17, dropped down to about 13, I think probably a week and a half ago, back up to about 17 at this point. You have markets still floating near all-time highs. You see that the S&P and the Dow and the NASDAQ were down slightly for the week. Nothing major because we saw some good numbers, you know, slow climb throughout the week, a little bit on lower volume for whatever that's worth. So right now we're kind of into a time where there is less volume as many traders are on vacation. Summertime generally shows that volumes dry up a little bit in a time, by the way, where trading volumes have significantly dropped. And you can tell that simply by asking any of the financial institutions out there, how are things going in terms of your trading departments? A lot of them doing layoffs, a lot of them are cutting back, a lot of them showing losses. Look at what Goldman said. Look at what Bank of America and their Merrill division and Morgan Stanley. Just take a look at their last reports and you'll see that there has been a major slowdown in overall trading. This is not only here in the U.S., but the same thing around the world. Now, some of that is due to the fact that there has been less of a, I think there has been less of an individual stock play and more of an ETF play, more of a mutual fund play, more of a, I would say, package product type of investor. And that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. But still, why are trading volumes drying up so significantly? You know, it's getting harder and harder, we know, for hedge funds to make money, especially without that inside information, right? That goes crackdowns. You know, we're seeing that there has been just a change in the dynamic of markets. And with the summer coming, I probably would say that we'd have to expect, with a lot of the things that are going on right now, with the Fed in play, Brexit, and China, that volatility is probably going to come back a little bit. So you can, you know, pick up some VIX options or pick up some VXX type of, you know, to protect the portfolio, that is. If you want to maintain some of your positions, you know, you can pick up some VIX options, maybe some short, short-term VIX ETFs like VXX. But understand something. The ETFs that operate with commodity-related products versus equity-related products have a very bad history of degradation due to various contract rolling features, et cetera. So these are short-term instruments that could see a very good move to the upside if markets do collapse or come in a bit. But remember something, it's not a position that you want to hold for a very, very long time. Now, if you want to hold it for a few weeks, okay, fine. But you'll notice that they don't keep track of and keep. I guess they don't keep on total parity with the VIX. So just be aware of that and be very careful of that. The other thing that I noticed that there are some levered ETFs that I like. There's some of them that keep a pretty good correlation to the underlying index. That's some that are terrible. Be aware that if you're going to be investing in any kind of levered ETF, whether it's a double or a triple, that you make sure to understand that when you do your analysis, this is not saying one being good or bad, or don't buy this one, don't buy that one, or buy this one or that one. What I'm talking about is the analysis. Now, this is something I've had on my list to discuss for a long time. When you do the analysis of, let's say, the gold miners, and let's say that you want to invest in the gold miners because you're seeing that there's a breakout. Well, what some people will do is that they will utilize the levered ETF, like for the long side of things, they will use an ETF that is three times the GDX, the gold miners, okay? So that's NUGT, for example, Nugget. Three times the gold miners index. And there's also a short version where you can be short or bet against it, which is NUGT. DUST, sorry. D-U-S-T is the negative and NUGT is the positive. Three times positive, three times negative. Nugget is the positive, DUST is the negative, or the short version. So if you want to bet that the GDX will be going up, you could lever it up by using Nugget. If you think that, hey, GDX is going to be going down, I'm going to lever it and short through the DUST position. Now, the problem is that some people use Nugget, NUGT, or DUST, UST, as their core symbol for analyzing if they should be buying or selling. That is 100% wrong. Never put those on a chart to do your technical analysis. Now, that's just one example of a position. There's plenty of others. But let's continue on with this discussion. You never want to use the levered, whether it's a two-time or a three-time levered ETF for technical analysis and analysis on your stocks. The reason for that is that they don't have the actual baseline because of the various ways that they invest and how they use derivative instruments inside of the portfolio to get to the three-time daily return. And because each day there is some potential degradation due to the way that it is structured, it will not have an actual technical, you will not have the technical ability in terms of charting it to really see the right numbers in terms of the overall potential for breakout or a breakdown. What you want to do instead is you want to utilize the core, the base. Use GDX. Put GDX on your chart. Track it. Make your decisions based on GDX for the initiation of a position, for your targeting of where you're going to get in and get out, where you're going to take your profits and your losses. And then you can buy the triple based on that. So what you do is you use the GDX as the baseline for your analysis, and then you buy a proxy. So you'll buy the dust or nugget. This way you get the truest reading on what the underlying ETF is doing, which holds the securities, no derivatives, assuming that's the case, assuming this is an ETF that doesn't have derivatives. It is a core ETF like the SPY or IWM. Those are the ones that you use for your small caps, your S&P 500. That's what you use for your analysis. And then if you want to lever it up by using some of these leveraged ETFs, you could do so. But don't get that mixed up. Make sure to stay on the core and do that. So many people, I think, misunderstand what the levered ETFs are, can be used for, and where they're really, where the problems are that are involved with them. So just be aware that these are really designed, especially the ones that are commodity related. They're designed to be short-term instruments, usually intraday trading, maybe a couple of day trading, but they will have degradation due to the futures roles and derivative roles and things that are inside the contract. Whereas some of the others that maybe are equity related don't have as much problem with that. They will track the pretty closely, many of them, the underlying. But still, you have to be very careful with that. There's a couple, like I said, that we like that will actually work really well, but just be careful with that. All right, so we talked about Brexit, talked about the week in review. I'll mention to you at this point that, of course, if you want to listen to myself and John C. Dvorak, each and every Tuesday we have a great show. We have things like the DH Unplugged Old Codger Index Portfolio competing against the Millennials ETF. Kind of a cool little competition. You got to check that out over on DH Unplugged. We have our weekly stock picks there as well. And we also have our Closest to the Pin game, where you can actually win some prizes by guessing the price of a stock sometime in the future that we lay out. Right now running, I believe, is Biogen. We just finished up with Fitbit. Biogen is actually running. You put your price guess in for where Biogen is going to be on a particular date that we have predetermined. You'll see that on the site. And you can actually win a great DH Unplugged t-shirt and some other things that we have there. So that's pretty cool. Of course, if you want information on the portfolios that we manage at Horowitz & Company, there's a variety of ones. You can always go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, check out all the things that are available there, and see what's happening there. Of course, vote for DH Unplugged if you haven't done so already on Podcast Awards. DH Unplugged is up for an award for the best in business. I didn't put the Disciplined Investor in this year. I don't know why. Just didn't do it. But DH Unplugged is in the running for the best business podcast over at Podcast Awards. So please definitely take a moment and go over there and vote. As a matter of fact, you can vote every single day. You just go over there, click the button, put your name and email address in, and then when it comes back, you confirm it, and you're in great shape. Other than that, what else was I going to mention? I mentioned that. Okay. Oh, and we have some great guests coming. Hey, listen, if you haven't listened to last week's discussion with Ben Hunt, I really encourage you to do so. He writes Epsilon Theory and is with Salient. And we had a great discussion on the whole Eurozone and on central banks and on game theory. I thought it was a really cool discussion that I think you'll really enjoy. Anyway, we're going to end it here. I want to thank you for joining me. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter handle. And if you have any questions, just simply write them to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Well, thank you again for joining me each and every week. Make sure to tell your friends, and I'll see you next week. Thanks.
The Dis- Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.